Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Marriage. Is it on the rocks? No, I'm not talking about your marriage in particular, although what we discuss today may have some bearing on that. Rather, I am interested in what is happening to marriage as an institution writ large in the United States. A recent report by the National Marriage Project at the University of Virginia and the Center for Marriage and Families at the Institute for American Values claims that the institution of marriage is disappearing from our nation's landscape, or at least seems to be heading into a state of crisis. That report, which we will link to directly on our website, is entitled When Marriage Disappears, The New Middle America, and is the 2010 version of the annual report known as The State of Our Unions, published by the aforementioned groups. The editor of that report, W. Bradford Wilcox, is our guest today. Dr. Wilcox is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Virginia, the director of the National Marriage Project, and a member of the James Madison Society at Princeton University. Some pretty fancy credentials there, if I might say so. Professor Wilcox is also the author of the book Soft Patriarchs, New Men, How Christianity Shapes Fathers and Husbands, which I found to be a really superb book, and in all actuality, I want him to talk about that line of research on fatherhood on our podcast today, but he's all insisting on this marriage stuff, so, you know, given that's consumed the bulk of his attention recently, I figured we would go ahead and do that. Nonetheless, I do plan to link to that book on our website, and I'm going to try to trick him into talking about that later on in the podcast, but don't tell him that. Brad, welcome to Research on Religion.
It's great to be here, Tony.
Now, you didn't hear anything about me tricking you into talking about
no,
yourself.
No, not at all.
Okay, good. All right. I just want to make sure because, you know, got to keep that surprise for later. Well, typically here on Research on Religion, our format is to provide some background to the topic that we're talking about before we get to the punchline of that research. But today, I'm just going to fast forward to the point about your empirical conclusions here and ask you a straightforward question. Is the institution of marriage in America in crisis and disappearing, as the title of your report says?
Well, you know, Tony, I think that marriage is in crisis, but we have to be clear here. What we are saying in the report is that it's in crisis for middle American, for moderately educated Americans who have a high school degree but not a college degree.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's also been in crisis for the least educated or poor Americans really since the 1970s. So the answer to your question is a qualified yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask about that term middle American, because when I came across this report initially, I saw the term middle America. I thought, okay, this is somebody in Kansas, Nebraska, Minnesota, middle America. But you have a different definition of what middle America is. What is that?
Yes, our definition is for middle America is that refers to Americans who have a high school degree, who may have some college, may have some additional vocational training, but have not gotten a college degree. And this portion of the adult population makes about 58%, you know, of the American adult population. So that group is who we're talking about when we say middle American. And of course, they would be more likely to be found in the heartland. They'd be more likely to be found in small towns and rural communities, in the outer suburbs, and they'd be less likely to be found in the inner suburbs and the more high-rent neighborhoods in many of our nation's cities.
Okay, which would be by more upper class. And the same thing, too, they probably wouldn't be found in what we would consider to be the inner-city poor neighborhoods and such, right?
Exactly. So that's right. So they're not going to be found in your poorest central city urban neighborhoods either.
Now, you had mentioned that the institution of marriage has been in crisis for the lowest educated segment of our population, the poorest segment of our population, for several decades now, dating back to the 1960s or 70s. And recently we've seen this trend seeping into what you call middle America, is what we just defined here. Now, what are the main indicators or metrics that are you are using to establish that conclusion?
Yeah, I'm thinking of things like divorce. I'm thinking of things like, single parenthood. I'm thinking of things like having a child outside of wedlock. And what we see is that, you know, those kinds of indicators, things like divorce, single parenthood, non-marital childbearing, all those indicators start, you know, rising in the late 1960s. And they rise first among Americans who are either poor or African-American.
Mm-hmm.
And what this report basically is showing us is that that shift in American family life is now moving up the social ladder to the point where we're seeing more whites, and we're seeing, you know, many more Americans who have a high school degree, and, you know, 50 years ago would have been following a very kind of conventional marital track, are now getting off that marital track, and they're more likely to get divorced, but especially they're more likely to be cohabiting and having kids outside of marriage.
Give us some indication of this trend so that we have some idea of what we're talking about here in terms of divorce figures. What has been happening with divorce among the entire population, then, you know, break it down into these different groups, the poor, the middle Americans, and then the educated, more educated sector. What's going on there?
Well, one of the larger points we make in the report is that the family patterns of this moderately educated group of Americans, this middle American group, are coming to resemble those found among the least educated or poorest Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to divorce, we actually see that overall in the American married population, divorce has come down modestly since 1980.
Which has been fairly good news.
Certainly, yeah, I would say so. But the class story there is a bit nuanced. So, you know, in our data, for instance, what we find is that from the 1970s to the 1990s, when you look at the first 10 years of marriage, there's been a modest, actually, decline in divorce among the least educated. There's been a modest increase among those who are moderately educated. And there's been a more marked decline among those who are college educated. So what that means is that today, in the first 10 years of a first marriage, what we're seeing here is that women who are high school educated or women who are high school dropouts have about a 36% chance of, you know, of divorcing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, on that particular statistic, it doesn't seem like it's that, you know, that big of a deal. But the issue, though, is that what's also happening here is that among the high school dropout group, very few of those folks are now going on to get married in the first place.
That's what I was going to ask. I'm taking a look at figure one in your report here. And again, I'm going to link to this on our website, and I invite our listeners to check it out. It's actually a free report, so you don't have to pay anything to go there and look at it. And here in figure one, you show in 1970 to 1974, the least educated had a divorce rate within the first 10 years of marriage of 46%. And in the later 1990s, that drops to 36%. And again, that we have to be careful with our metrics and our statistics here. Oftentimes, they can be misleading based upon what the measure is. But you made a very important point here that what you see in that decline in the divorce rate is really also a reflection of people never getting married in the first place. If you don't get married, you can't get divorced.
Right, and this is really most true for those who are high school educated, and especially those who are high school dropouts, because what we're seeing is that group, or those two groups, are seeing the strongest declines in their marriage rates. So on the divorce front, you know, it's not a particularly strong story, but what you can also say, of course, too, from this research is that Americans who do not have a college degree are three times more likely to get divorced than Americans who have a college degree. And as you know, as a social scientist, that's a pretty dramatic gap. But there's this huge gap between those who are college educated and those who are not when it comes to their risk of divorce in this society today.
Yeah, that is a good way of looking at it. And as we're talking right now about the divorce rate, what your report does, I think, very well is highlight the fact that there's more to the measurement of the health of marriage than simply looking at divorce rates. Because again, when I started paging through this report, I looked, the first thing that comes up was the divorce rate. I said, eh, that doesn't look too bad. I mean, yes, the moderately educated are three times more likely than the highly educated, but the trend hasn't changed that much. There's been some other things happening, though, in terms of marriage that you get at with a number of different measures. And what would that be?
Yeah, so I mean, one of my big points that I think it's important to communicate here is that divorce was the sort of the premier family problem in American life in the 1970s and early 1980s. And, you know, since then, I think what has begun to emerge is that cohabitation and non-marital childbearing, which of course go hand in hand increasingly today, mm-hmm. are, you know, the biggest problems now facing American family life and facing kids in particular. And we see this in part in the report. We look at those who have ever cohabited, and we can see in figure 4 of our report that cohabitation is much more common among those who are moderately educated and those who are high school dropouts. It's less common among the college educated set. But even more important than that, in figure 5, we see there's been a dramatic increase in non-marital childbearing for Americans who have a high school degree and Americans who are high school dropouts. And the increase for Americans who are college educated is comparatively modest. So what we're seeing now in this country is that, you know, about 1 in 2 kids being born to Americans who don't have college degrees, that is to women who don't have college degrees, are being born outside of marriage. And it's, you know, just 6% for women who've got a college degree. And this gap, this marriage gap in childbearing, just is getting bigger and bigger, as this particular figure indicates, because, you know, more and more couples who are cohabiting in this moderately educated group and this least educated group, more and more of those couples are deciding to just have the child and not to try to get married before they have kids.
You know, let me give I'm taking a look at figure 4 and figure 5 here. Let's just give an indication of what, to our listeners, what is going on here. In terms of cohabitation, amongst the least educated population in 1998, 51% of women between 25 and 44 had reported cohabiting, so about half of them. This jumps to 75% roughly in 2006 to 2008. Among the moderately educated, the folks that you're calling middle American, the difference of rates of cohabitation goes from 39% in the late 1980s to 68% in just a few years ago. And then among the most highly educated, there's also an increase, but it's not as steep. You see 35% reporting cohabitation at that point in the late 1980s, and that jumps up to about 50% there. And as you mentioned here, too, the percentage of births to never married women between the ages of 15 and 44, this is where you see this huge dramatic. And your measures here are from 1982 to 2006 and 2008. And amongst the least educated, it was about 1 in 3. That there was a percentage of birth to never married women in 1982, and that jumps to 54%. Among the moderately educated, it was quite low in the late 80s, 13%, and now it has jumped to 44%. So that is, you know, nearly a fourfold increase in that. Amongst the most highly educated, still fairly rare, only 2% of women in the 1980s had given birth to, or who were never married and gave birth, and that's about 6% right now. So that's
just a side note. It's interesting to see in the data as well, when you break this out by race, that there has been no increase in non-marital childbearing for white college-educated women from 1982 to the present. So, you know, I think one of the points we make in the report is that, you know, many college-educated Americans, many white college-educated Americans, in the abstract, are progressive, liberal, tolerant of any number of kind of, you know, topics and issues, including family diversity in general. But when it comes to actually their own lives, mm-hmm. what this report, you know, indicates very clearly is that they are quite conventional in terms of getting married first, then having kids, and finally staying married once they are married. So, you know, there's a kind of a marriage mindset that's actually kind of taken hold among the college-educated set, particularly whites in the U.S. and Asian Americans in the U.S. And, you know, no matter what they might believe in general or in the abstract about things like gay marriage, things like abortion, when it comes to governing their own lives and, you know, sort of figuring out how they want to negotiate all this, they actually took a very conventional path on the marriage front.
That's a really interesting observation, and I want to bring this up into what I called the so what question. Why does any of this stuff matter? And I'm sure our listeners already have some ideas about that anyways. But that observation that ideologically or ideationally a lot of well-educated women and even men are like, oh yeah, cohabitation's great, you know, don't worry about getting married, kids outside of family. I'm thinking back to the controversy in the early 1990s over the Murphy Brown character that was played by Candace Bergen, when she had a upper class woman, successful career, had a child out of wedlock, and Dan Quayle, the vice president under George H.W. Bush at the time, criticized this. It raised a firestorm amongst the intellectual elite, the punditry, saying, oh, that's, you know, fine. That's not old-fashioned notions that you have there, Dan Quayle. Please get rid of those. And those opinion leaders, the Murphy Brown's characters of the world, really have an influence on the middle Americans that you're talking about, as well as the low-income Americans. And what's interesting, as you just noted, was that their ideational view of the world does not match with their practice. And if you're somehow sending out these signals that, yeah, you know, Murphy Brown can have a kid out of wedlock, so go ahead, you folks in the poor neighborhoods, go ahead and do that. That can be fairly detrimental.
No, that's exactly right. And I think particularly when it comes to our popular culture, and when it comes to the signals that our institutions, you know, of law and education and healthcare send to the broader population, including middle America, I think the message that is sent out is that marriage is not important, mm-hmm. that you can have kids in any kind of context, that dads are not really that important. You know, and yet, you know, the irony here is when it comes to how this elite governs their own lives, they are very attentive to marriage, and they're very attentive to trying to keep things together. You know, I think increasingly so, judging by the data, you know, for their own kids. So there is a real tension between the sort of public culture that we operate here in the United States and the way in which well-educated Americans have kind of insulated themselves against that culture and are not kind of following the signals that you would get if you look at, for instance, you know, People magazine or, you know, any other kind of, you know, journal today in the checkout line, which is sort of trumping the latest Hollywood misadventure.
Yeah. Well, that brings me to the so what question. Let me play the Murphy Brown character, the intellectual elite here now saying, yeah, you know, cohabitation, you know, come on, that marriage institution, that's an old-fashioned concept. So cohabitation, no big deal. And, you know, out-of-child wedlocks, hey, parents can do it on their own. There's a lot of, you know, help in society for this kind of stuff, school and that. So, yeah, so what about this stuff? Why should we worry about it?
Well, you know, Tony, I was raised by a single mother, and I think that she did a pretty good job of raising me and my sister. But I'm also a sociologist, and I can tell you as a sociologist who has, you know, read, you know, more than my share of studies looking at the impact of family structure on children, that kids are more likely to thrive and are even more likely to survive when they're raised in an intact married household with their mom and their dad. We know, for instance, from work that Sarah McClanahan at Princeton has done, that boys who grow up outside of a home with their father are more than twice as likely to end up spending some time in prison before they turn age 32, and this is controlling for things like, you know, education, income, and race differences, you know, among those young men. We know also that girls who are raised outside of a home with their father are more likely to become active sexually at a young age and to become pregnant. In fact, if dad leaves before a girl turns 6, she's 7 times more likely to have a teenage pregnancy compared to a girl who has her father in the household, you know, for the duration of her childhood. I could go on with more studies and more figures, but the fundamental point here simply is this, is that kids are more likely to do well when their parents, you know, get and stay married. And I think what's happened among the elite, you know, Americans, is that they've somehow kind of gotten that message. They know, for instance, their kids are more likely to go to the University of Washington, to the University of Virginia, to Harvard, to Columbia, if they manage to get married and stay married. And that's not, you know, that's not a sort of a minor consideration for them when they're facing, you know, a spot of marital distress.
Right. No, that's true.
So I think that kind of recognition has seeped into the consciousness of many well-educated Americans, and they're acting accordingly.
Mm-hmm. Well, we talk a little bit about elite Americans here, and I want to hold the middle American group that your report tends to focus on, or at least in the title. Hold that aside for a minute and concentrate on the poor group, the least educated, which are likely to be correlated with low socioeconomic status and that. Why is marriage fragile and weak among the poor? What happened back in the 1960s and 70s to really undermine the institution of marriage among this population?
Well, what happened in the 1960s and 70s is both a kind of a cultural story and an economic story. And my argument about marriage would be that marriage depends upon two strong pillars. It depends upon kind of a strong cultural pillar, you know, a series of norms and meaning-producing institutions that support marriage. And it depends on a kind of, you know, socioeconomic pillar where there's a set of economic institutions and resources that allow people to form and to sustain, you know, strong marriages. And what happened in the late 60s and the 1970s was that both of these two pillars became weaker, particularly for, you know, for low-income Americans. So on the economic front, you know, we see in both in my report and in other research that that poor men had sort of less access to stable, decent-paying jobs. And if you know anything about marriage, if you've experienced marriage, you know that when a guy doesn't have a decent job, he's much less attractive as a potential spouse. And that's the case not just for, I think, the woman in the picture, but also for the guy. I mean, he doesn't necessarily see himself as a potential, you know, husband in that situation. And if he is to go on and get married and he's facing real difficulty on the employment front, that's gonna strain the marriage. So that's one point that's important to make. And that's a point that people like, you know, William Julius Wilson at Harvard would make. That's kind of the standard liberal line. Mm-hmm. But the other point I make is that kind of a broader cultural support system for marriage also eroded in the late 60s and 70s. The sex revolution, of course, mm-hmm. undercut the connection between sex, marriage, and parenthood. The rise of kind of the me generation made people focus a lot more on their own psychological well-being rather than that of their, you know, their potential spouse, you know, kids, etc. So you had a kind of a number of cultural shifts that undercut the need to, number one, get married in the first place, and number two, get, you know, to stay married in the second place. And so you know, these all kind of give way to a certain degree in the late 60s and 70s, and everyone was affected, but I think the poor were most affected because their kind of economic stake in marriage has always been somewhat weaker, and, you know, given the shifts in our economy, it was made even weaker by the fact that the men in many poor communities were losing access to stable jobs, which, you know, right. generally speaking, help to propel men into marriage and then keep them married in the second place.
Yeah, both of those were pretty tenuous, and any shift in one of them is going to have a major impact in that regard. I do want to come back to the cultural issues here in a second and really talk about the issue of religion, which we are a podcast on religion, so I want to put the focus on that, although the institution of marriage has lots of religious connotations associated with it, and which is why we chose the topic for this week. But I want to talk about the wealthy in a minute, and when I tend to look at the divorce figures, and, you know, I tend to think more like an economist than a sociologist in many respects, I think about the creation of no-fault divorce laws in the 1970s, and for me, the no-fault divorce laws would seem to have given a jolt, or at least pushed, made divorce more easily among the upper-income cohort. Why hasn't that really been the case, and why has marriage really remained strong and stable amongst the most highly educated and the wealthiest of Americans?
Well, you know, you do see in our report that divorce was more common back in the 1970s for, you know, highly educated Americans yeah. than it is today for them.
That is true.
So, you know, everyone is basically affected by the divorce revolution of the 1970s, but, you know, it's also clear that they were less affected even then by that revolution than were you know, less affluent Americans, and I think what it comes down to in part is, you know, is this, and that is that people who are more educated, who are more affluent, tend to have, you know, more joint assets and assets that are worth a lot of money, and especially if you have a home. And, you know, if you own a home with your spouse, that's a big, you know, economic force pushing you to stay together, to try to work things out, because you're going to lose, you know, pretty big, particularly over the long term, if you try to, you know, get divorced, sell that asset, et cetera, et cetera. Not to mention, you know, pay the attorney fees and all that kind of stuff. So I think that there's a kind of, you know, even back in the 70s, there's a way in which people who are more affluent recognize at some level, often at a tacit level, that to kind of go down the road of getting divorced has, you know, is likely to have a pretty big financial impact on their well-being.
You have a really interesting figure again here in the report. Relating to that, it's figure 8 in the report. For those of you who you want to go and check this out, check out the link on our website. It's the percentage of 25 to 60-year-olds believing that divorce should be made more difficult to obtain. So these are people who are supporting more difficult or more stringent divorce laws. And you compare this from the 1970s to the 2000s. And what you see among the least educated was 53% thought divorce laws should be made more difficult in the 1970s among the least educated. And that's compared to 36% of highly educated individuals in the 1970s. Now, this flips in a fairly significant way. Among the least educated in the past decade, only 40%, that's down from 53%, believe that divorce should be made more difficult. So they're the lower class thinking that we should liberalize divorce laws, were amongst the highly educated in the 70s, as I mentioned, it was 36%. It's now almost 50%, 48%. So it seems that the more highly educated are more in favor nowadays of more stringent divorce laws.
Yeah, and that's one of the interesting things that comes out of the report. Is actually, I also looked at the GSS attitudes towards same-sex marriage and towards abortion, and we see a kind of enduring class divide when it comes to those hot-button issues, where college-educated Americans still are much more progressive than their less-educated peers on those two issues. But on this issue of divorce, as you just mentioned, what we are seeing is that I think there's a kind of a marriage mindset that is emerging among the college-educated set, where once again, when it comes to their own marriages, when it comes to their own, you know, their own expectations for their teenage kids in terms of having a baby as a teenager, they are quite conventional, and they don't want their kids to have a teenage, to have a baby as a teenager, and they're, you know, they're pretty committed to their own marriages, and I think more so than the boomers were in the 1970s and early 80s.
Yeah. Again, it goes back to that point of, you know, it kind of strikes home to your own interest. You tend to deviate a little bit from more progressive values or ideas that you actually do have. Let me put this. Let's get back to middle America, and we've defined that earlier, and we gave some indication of what is going on there. But if you could give us an overview of your report, and your focus on this year's iteration of the report was really on middle America here. How drastic is that decline in marriage values, attitudes toward marriage among middle America?
So your question is how dramatic is this decline?
Yeah, and in a number of different measures. We talked a little bit about divorce before, but in general, if you had to sum this up and say, is this something that we really should be worrying about? Is it happening pretty quick? That's where
I'm I think it is obviously pretty worrisome, and I think what people are missing when they look at some of the overall trends in marriage is that, yeah, the divorce rate's come down since 1980, but that's in part because fewer Americans, particularly in these less educated precincts, are getting married in the first place. And as we see, you know, in Table 5, there's this dramatic increase in non-marital childbearing among Americans who don't have college degrees, to the point, as I said before, 1 in 2.
Right.
And that seems to be only increasing from year to year. So, you know, my concern is that many 20-somethings in these less educated sectors are cohabiting and having kids in that context. And the problem with that, of course, is that cohabiting unions are about 3 times more likely to break up than are married unions when kids are involved. And so kids are being exposed to a kind of revolving carousel of relationships and particularly worrisome unrelated adult males who are coming through the household. And we know from a lot of research on child abuse that kids are much more likely to be abused when there's instability in the household and when you have unrelated men coming through the household. So, you know, in terms of what's happening here and why I think it's of concern, is that we're seeing more instability, more cohabitation, and, you know, that's not very good for our, you know, for our kids. Now, it's still the case that among this middle American group, the majority of them are having their kids, you know, in marriage, and I think we need to sort of recognize that and try to figure out what we can do to stabilize the situation and to, you know, to reverse the tide here.
Mm-hmm.
But if we don't do something, I think we're going to be in a situation down the road where you have an educated, affluent elite who enjoys access to money, power, and stable families, all of which tend to only increase their privilege and the privilege of their children.
You do note that. In the report, you claim that this drop in marriage stability is causing the American dream to fall out of reach of too many Americans, and primarily talking about middle Americans. What do you mean by that?
What I mean simply is that we know that kids who are reared in stable, intact married households are more likely to do well in school, they're more likely to be stably employed, and they're more likely to go on and form and sustain their own marriages, their own families successfully. And I think, you know, getting a decent education, getting a decent job, having a decent family, these are all kind of crucial components of the American dream. And so to the extent that high school educated Americans and their kids are less likely now to be able to access or, you know, to attain a strong married life, they're not going to be as likely to pass on, you know, these sort of set of goods to their kids, which undercuts their kids' ability to achieve the American dream.
And as you mentioned, you know, just a minute ago, I'm talking about how we can possibly stem this decline. I mean, this obviously has huge policy implications related to a variety of government policies. But also, and I want to connect this here because this is the general topic area of our podcast, is the issue of religion. Now, you don't talk very much about that in your report, but I know your work in other fields, you have focused on the sociology of religion quite a bit. What do you think is going on in the United States in terms of religion that relates to these trends that you notice in your report?
We do find there's been a marked decline in church going among, you know, moderately educated and the least educated portions of the population. So we see, for instance, that back in the 1970s, middle Americans were actually more likely to attend church than any group in the society. More so, for instance, than college-educated Americans. Whereas today, what we see is that only 26% of them, you know, are attending, and that's less than the percentage of those who are college-educated. So the point here simply is that if you look at people's connection to a church community, which, you know, from my research, we know is a strong predictor of getting married, of staying married, of being happily married, fewer middle Americans and fewer poor Americans, fewer Americans or high school dropouts are connected to a church community that would lend strength and stability to their marriage and family life more generally. So that's certainly a big part of the story here. It's just been kind of there's been a kind of secularization that's taken place among Americans, but that's really been concentrated, as figure 20 indicates, among Americans who don't have college degrees.
Yeah, paint me a little bit of a skeptic on that front. I mean, from the research that I've been doing and looking at religious tendencies, there's always a tendency by mainline denominations to decry the downfall of religion in America or secularization in America, but there seems to be a lot of other avenues, different religious avenues that are popping up, mega churches and non-denominational churches and such, that are going up all around America. And we just recently had a podcast with Mark Driscoll of the Mars Hill Church, who created a huge mega church in downtown Seattle, which really reaches out to a lot of 20-something, especially men, 20-something men, which is kind of amazing. So I don't know if... What are your thoughts on this secularization trend here in the United States? Is it really drastic? Is it, you know, do you, I don't know. Give me some thoughts on that.
Well, you know, I think what we're seeing seeing is polarization in the population at large, where we're seeing, you know, some modest increases in the sort of percentage of Americans, including Americans who kind of take their faith very seriously, the kinds of young people who would be attracted to Mark Driscoll's church, for instance.
Yeah.
But I think what we're seeing is kind of the erosion of the religious middle, you know, and we have seen dramatic declines in membership and attendance among mainline Protestants and among white Catholics as well. So, you know, what I would say is that overall our society is a bit more secular, and yet there's also kind of this other group, this, you know, this subculture that is, you know, more orthodox in their orientation, mm-hmm. More active in the religious communities that, you know, continues to grow in some quadrants of American life. So, it, you know, it's a complex story there, but I think my suspicion, and I don't know Mark Driscoll's church very well at all, I mean, I've heard about it, but my suspicion is that Mark Driscoll, just because of where he's located, you know, is not reaching people who are living in rural and small town eastern, well, you know, eastern Washington State.
Yes.
You know, the point is that if you were to kind of to sort of take your gaze and move from Seattle to, you know, say 20 miles south of Spokane, I would bet a lot of money that the 25-year-old or 30-year-old young man, you know, in a town there, mm-hmm. is much less likely to be attending church today than, you know, his father was, you know, say 30 years ago. So that's part of the sort of point we're making in the report. There's been a kind of a civic, a religious, and an employment deinstitutionalization taking hold in many middle American and poor communities since the 70s.
Yeah, and since, you know, religion and religious groups tend to focus a great deal on the sanctity of marriage, if you're not getting those 20-something-year-old males and even 20-something-year-old females into the pews on Sunday, it's not surprising that that cultural pillar is starting to erode, as you talked about earlier. Now, when we were discussing this podcast over email, you suggested to me that we call this episode, As the Family Goes, So Goes the Church. And, well, one, I get to decide the title, I should tell you that. But I thought that was interesting, because what we just mentioned here was that the weakness in religiosity or the increasing secularization in American society is undermining religion. But what you suggested there, it seems like the undermining of marriage is also undermining religion in that pathway or that causal pathway.
Yeah, completely, yeah. No, I mean, as you know, as a social scientist, it's hard to know, you know, we talk about endogeneity in the research, of course, it's chicken and egg in ordinary parlance. But what I can say, I think very, you know, clearly and confidently is there's a very strong association, you know, in the data between getting married, staying married, and church going for Americans, particularly for American men. And when marriage breaks down, American adults are less likely, you know, to be regular churchgoers, and that's particularly true for men. So, I mean, I find, for instance, in one study that about a third of the decline in church attendance since the 70s, at least looking at the GSS data, can be attributed to shifts in marriage, and it's the biggest factor of, you know, of the things that I was looking at in terms of differences over time in education, income, and other kind of standard social, you know, and cultural factors that one might look at. So, I think that basically, you know, when the family breaks down, religion takes it on the chin. Now, this is particularly true, though. This is one important caveat for the more mainstream churches, like, you know, the mainline Protestant churches, the Catholic Church, because for those traditions, or the Reformed Jewish tradition, for instance, for those traditions, what often happens is that their members don't really show up until they get married and have kids. And they want to expose their kids to a certain kind of, you know, religious and moral perspective,
right,
that they think that, you know, the congregation can supply to them. Whereas people who are, you know, either already devout or who are looking for community and meaning and purpose, those types of people will often gravitate towards more sectarian traditions, be it the, you know, the evangelical church like Mars Hill in Seattle, or to a Jehovah's Witness group, or to an LDS church,
mm-hmm.
And they're going to sort of either be attracted to that tradition or stick with that tradition, you know, even before they're married, know, or even if they're not married. So, you know, the point I'm making here is I think it's particularly the more kind of mainstream or churchly traditions that are especially dependent upon strong families.
Yeah, that's an absolutely interesting phenomenon or interesting observation. I hadn't thought about that before, because what you do tend to see patterns in the behavior that, you know, children go to church, and then when they reach their upper teen years or early in their 20s, when they're leaving the nest and such, and they have many other things they do, many other exciting things on Saturday nights to attend to, they tend to fade away from the church. But once they get married and then have their own kids, it's back to the church. And as you mentioned, well, we need to inculcate our children with some moral values, values that might not be appearing anymore in the public schools. We just had a podcast on homeschooling that dealt with this issue a bit. Yeah, but if you get cohabitation, if you get missing fathers that or divorce here, one can only imagine that it's just more difficult for the single mom to drag the kids to church, and you don't have the moral authority of the father saying, well, you know, get your butt in the car, kids, we're going to church, and that's going to fade away. You think that's what's going on here?
Yeah, no, I do think that's what's, you know, that's what's going on here, and that is that it's much easier to, you know, to get your kids to, you know, to church when you're actually sharing a household with your, with the parent of your kids.
And it's fascinating, too, you mentioned that this is the mainline churches rather than the evangelicals. I hadn't thought about this. I don't know if you, I mean, has there been a research agenda set on this? Because part of the purpose of research here, research on religion here, is that we like to suggest interesting topics for dissertations or for people to investigate. And this is one that now is starting to take form in my mind here, that, you know, it is the parents who faded away from the church but then want to take their kids to Sunday school are going to be more inclined to go to the Presbyterian church down the road, one, because it's closer, or number two, they have the program that you knew as a kid or something like that, as compared to these evangelical churches where you observe they're the ones that are more likely to attract the devout people who are going throughout their 1920s. You know, any research being done on this stuff?
No, I've done some work on this, Tony, and certainly find that this is the story. I guess I also point out just the irony that both, I think, academics who study religion and mainline Protestant leaders oftentimes are clamoring for a progressive, kind of tolerant approach to family diversity, kind of blissfully ignorant of the fact that, you know, it's precisely this mentality, this sort of ethos that has been, you know, and continues to be implicated in their marginalization, religiously speaking anyways. There's a deep irony here, and yet for obvious reasons these folks cannot extract themselves from embracing a sort of family diversity ethic that you know, basically guarantees that there'll be fewer and fewer Episcopalian and mainline Presbyterian Methodist churches, you know, not to mention UCC churches, you know, 30 or 40 years from now.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating. We're going to have to link to some of your work on some of this stuff. And I want to come back to the parents going to the evangelical churches, which is going to get me back to some of your earlier research, which I really enjoy. But before we go there, you wrote a report. The report is out there. As I mentioned, we linked to it on our website here. And it's really to ring a warning bell, I think, to American society. And given that, what kind of policy responses do you think would be appropriate for governments to take in relation to what you're seeing in your marriage report, or if at all? I mean, maybe the government shouldn't be involved in this whatsoever. So if you had to be, if you were placed on a commission to solve this problem, what would you suggest?
Well, you know, first of all, I have to say that I think that, you know, the marriage problem that we're now confronting is going to be solved primarily in places like Madison Avenue, Hollywood, and not to mention kind of the family rooms, the kitchen, you know, the kitchen tables of ordinary Americans. Washington, D.C. and our state capitals, you know, be they Olympia or Richmond in my case, can only do so much, right. I think, to confront this challenge. But having said that, I think there are some things that we can do, and I'm actually not a big fan of doing a lot of intensive social work or education around this issue, because I think that, you know, that social workers and that educators, you know, who are being paid by government can only say so much and do so much, and often they can act in ways that are counterproductive. But what I think we can do is to try to get the incentive structures right, and we can also do a better job of communicating to the public in a kind of public service, you know, announcement campaign, a PSA campaign, how it is that marriage is valuable and dads are valuable to the broader public. So on the first issue, I think we need to, number one, eliminate the marriage penalty that's embedded in many means-tested policies that serve the poor and working-class Americans. So, for instance, looking at things like, you know, food stamps or public assistance when it comes to housing, what you see is that people who are cohabiting often don't, you know, report that status and are able to get, you know, public benefits, whereas if they were to report this, you know, to get married and report that fact, they would lose those benefits. So we have to, I think, as a first step, eliminate the marriage penalty that's embedded in many of our policies, unwittingly, but nevertheless is embedded in those policies.
Yeah, so what you're essentially, you know, talking about here when you talked about your two pillars earlier, that the government really has to rethink the way that it structures economic incentives to deal with that, the crumbling of the economic pillar that you had mentioned earlier.
That's right. And the second thing that I think we need to do on the legal front in terms of getting the incentives right is to reform divorce law. We're not going to go back to a fault-based divorce system. That's not going to happen. But I think what we can do is to establish a new norm of marital responsibility. And by that I mean that what we can say is that when there's a unilateral divorce, when just one spouse wants to get out of a marriage, that in that context, the assumption is that the remaining spouse will have the primary custody and, you know, say the primary marital division of property, say 65%, unless the spouse who's leaving the marriage can assign responsibility to the other spouse for, you know, for things like, you know, clear breaches of the marital contract, you know, like domestic violence, a pattern of substance abuse, or something else that's, you know, that's really serious.
Right.
And by doing that, I think we would kind of restore a measure of legal confidence that people could have in marriage. And that's important because when we talk to working class and poor Americans, they often will recount examples, particularly true for men, where they themselves have been divorced unwillingly, or they've seen their father or, you know, uncle, whatever, get divorced. And they just think that marriage is kind of a, you know, kind of a trap that men can walk into and then be fleeced once, you know, the wife decides that she's, you know, wants to do something else. So that's the second point I would make. And the third and final point I would make is that we should do a PSA campaign like we've seen with the smoking issue to educate the public about the ways in which kids are more likely to thrive when parents, you know, get married, stay married, and when also there's a father in the picture.
Yeah. That brings me, and that's a nice segue to your work earlier in the Soft Patriarchs, New Men line of research that you conducted earlier. And this is what originally brought your research to my attention. I had the pleasure of reading your book, about six years ago or so. And the book is interesting in that it takes a look at evangelical men, evangelical Christian men, and that the stereotype of the evangelical Christian man is some kind of fire and brimstone tyrant in the family. What were your conclusions in the Soft Patriarchs book?
Yeah, well, just to kind of expand on your comment there, it's interesting if you look at like a lot of the public writing about evangelicals and conservative Protestants. You see, for instance, like Stephen Cokie Roberts speculated that their kind of moral traditionalism would lead to abuse, you know, with their kids. And John Gottman, who's, you know, there in Seattle, has talked about the religious right being a force for authoritarianism in American families. But when you look at the data, what you find, you know, by and large, is that religious fathers, including and especially in some ways evangelical fathers, tend to be more involved with their kids, more affectionate towards their children. They tend to have happier marriages, and if they're attending church, less domestic violence. So that doesn't, I mean, those kinds of outcomes don't square with the kind of concern that's articulated in many academic and media contexts. Now, it is true that evangelical fathers are more likely to spank their kids.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one area where they do take a kind of more straightforwardly traditional approach to child rearing. But, you know, on the other kind of domains that I look at in my work, you know, I find more affection, more involvement, and less domestic violence. So concretely, for instance, I find that active church-going evangelical dads spend about 3.5 hours more per week with their with their kids and activities like Boy Scouts and youth sports and whatnot, compared to dads who are not affiliated with a religious group of one sort or another. So the broader idea here is that religion promotes a kind of neo-traditional form of parenting, where more religious parents still stress the importance of authority and discipline, as they did, 50, 100, 200 years ago. Mm-hmm. But they're also kind of moving, I think, to spend more time with their kids and to do more on the positive emotional front, recognizing that these are important ways of communicating their love to their kids, and also kind of, I think, in some way, too, of countering the forces, the influences from the broader culture.
Mm-hmm. And it's not just with parenting either. I think it's within marriage. And there's, again, that stereotype, and we've addressed this with some previous podcasts. Brad Wright and Louis Bolse have come on talking about how the media and how the general public at large views evangelicals. We mentioned this in terms of fatherhood, but also in terms of spousal relationships and the marriage itself. There's always a concern in the media that if you go to one of these fundamentalist or evangelical churches, they talk about the wife submitting to the husband. That's the typical trope or the typical story that is often told there. And Mark Driscoll, too, has been a very strong proponent of marriage and has told the guys in his church to, hey, shape up and take responsibility for the marriage. The general view of this among the punditry is that, oh, this is going to lead to more spousal abuse, this is going to lead to more submissive women, it's going to be creating rocky marriages. Is that what you found?
No, not at all. What I find is that among those who are men who are, actively involved in an evangelical community, who are regular churchgoers, that their wives are the most likely to report that they're happy in their marriages. They have the lowest levels of domestic violence, and their divorce rates are comparable to those among other church-going men. They're about 35% less likely to get divorced,
mm-hmm.
Net of other kinds of factors. So certainly the story for active church-going men is pretty positive when it comes to their marriages. But there is one important caveat to all this, and that is that my own research indicates that nominally conservative Protestant or evangelical men, the guys, for instance, who attend a Southern Baptist church once or twice a year, or who are Southern Baptist but don't go to church at all, those guys are actually more likely to be abusive, they're more likely to get divorced, and to have a number of problems in their marriage compared to secular guys. And, I think understanding this group is a complex endeavor, because I think there are probably three things, in play here, if not more. Number one, they tend to have less education and income, which, of course, are risk factors. Number two, I think they often hail from a kind of Scotch-Irish working-class subculture that stresses the importance of honor and tends to be more impulsive in ways that probably aren't very good for marriages.
Mm-hmm.
But I think third, I don't think you can kind of let religion completely off, and this is where someone like Darren Churchill, I think, would probably be, jumping up and down right now. But I think Darren would say, I think actually he's right in this regard, that for a lot of these nominal conservative Protestant men, I think that they probably tend to use their religious background and tradition in a way to kind of legitimate bad behavior.
Yeah.
To kind of, harp on the fact that they're the head of the household and in order to, talk about the importance of using the rod with their kids. And so I think for this group of men, you could argue that religion is a baleful force in American life.
Mm-hmm. And one could see that, as you mentioned, that the group that tends to be involved in more spousal abuse and that yet connected religion are the folks that are going only a couple times a year. It seems that they're, I like this church because it can justify my lifestyle, even though they might not be heavily involved in it and know what the message of that religion might be.
Right, and there's no accountability, Mandrin. I mean, if they were attending regularly and their wife was coming in with a black and blue eye, I mean, things would start happening pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's true.
But, if it's just them living in the trailer park, in rural Washington or in southern Virginia, it's just them and their, and their circle. And, in that context, I think a little religion can be a bad thing.
Yeah. You think groups like the Promise Keepers and stuff could really be a positive influence on marriage in some of these places, such as what you term middle America and the lower socioeconomic groups?
Well, yeah. The problem, of course, is that Promise Keepers is no longer a really going concern.
Yeah.
And there certainly are, you know, many men's ministries, but I think we could do a lot more and should do a lot more across religious traditions to strengthen, number one, men's ministries, and then number two, to recognize that we need to do a lot more to reach out to working class and poor communities, and not just to do quote-unquote charity, but to really, you know, revive the religious fortunes of these communities. I mean, for instance, there's no intervarsity group that is targeting, you know, the tons of high school students who are not going to go into college.
Right, right.
And so they're just kind of left to drift away from the church. And so what I think we need to do is to be more intentional, both about reaching out to men in particular, and secondarily in terms of being more intentional about reaching out to Americans who are not on the college track.
Yeah, I think that is a clarion call for some of our churches, and this goes back to a podcast that we had with Marissa Davis on the Black churches and their role in promoting the family and parenthood and such, that the churches play an incredibly important role. And, you know, groups like Promise Keepers that are not as are not around anymore, but nonetheless, these things can be embedded in the ministries of various other churches and congregations around the country, that it might be something that would be of interest to these individuals in terms of what you were talking about, PSA announcements for the culture in general. Maybe some of these PSA announcements should be really directed at some of these churches.
Yeah, well, no, I think that's exactly right. I mean, to sort of, as I said, to encourage the religious community to sort of step up and realize that they can play a role in helping to turn things around.
Well, Brad, it has been a pleasure talking with you about this issue, and we'll keep track on it. As mentioned before, you're with the organization that publishes this, or the director of that organization that publishes this on a yearly basis. So hopefully we'll see some changes in the trends and positive direction. We'll be sure to check with you in the future. So thank you for being on Research on Religion.
It's my pleasure, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.